continuation of 1718 modes, Mayapur, January 21, 2009. Okay, destination, higher planets, or birth on Earth as a poet. Birth on Earth, that's cool, as a poet or scientist. Mode of passion, if you're really together, you get power and wealth. Human body on the earthly planet, and ignorance, animals, or lower planets. Worship. Okay. Those in the mode of goodness. In these chapters, Krishna says, worship the demigods. In passion, they worship demons. In ignorance, they worship ghosts and spirits. We read different things in different places. Sometimes it says those in the mode of goodness are interested in the Brahman. Okay. In Ishopanishad, it says the worshippers of the demigods go to the darkest region of ignorance, which is interesting. And there are plenty of demons who worship demigods, aren't there? So you can't just look at the object of worship. You also have to look at the mood of worship, the purpose of worship, right? The gopis are worshiping demigods, and Ravana is worshiping a demigod. So it's not just who you worship. And when we talk about worship, we don't just mean formal worship. Just like in modern society, people are worshiping, what was that, Princess Diana, Michael Jackson, right? They're practically like gods to people. Yes?
I was just in regards to worship. In the slokas in 1831 and 32, it gives, in 31, the worship in the mode of passion, and then the mode of ignorance in text 32. But to me, they both seem to be the same. They're like, it's easier. Or some of the that understanding which cannot distinguish between religion and irreligion.
Okay, that's understanding. We're not there yet.
Oh, okay.
Can you hold it?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, I understand what you're talking about. Yes. Okay. Good point. Anyway, so people in the mode of ignorance, those that they venerate are very low creatures. Though in the mode of passion, they venerate people who are materialistic, who are not interested in spiritual life, and those in the mode of goodness, they venerate those who are elevated, is basically. Who do you venerate? Because we're not here talking about puja. We're not talking about a formal worship. Because remember in chapter 16, the demarcation between divine and demoniac is, do you follow the scriptures? So Arjuna is kind of saying, suppose you don't follow the scriptures. Are you all in the same category? Is everyone who doesn't follow the scriptures in exactly the same category? Krishna is saying, no. There's different categories. So this is not talking about scriptural worship. This is talking about who you revere, who you venerate, who you think is a great person. And I have seen people really worship demons or ghosts and spirits. And when I saw one woman walking on the streets of New York who had her cheeks pierced, and she had fangs coming out, silver fangs coming out of her cheeks. And I saw people at Woodstock in Poland who, when we took the Rath Yatra cart by them, they were playing music that sounded like jackals and wolves. I thought, that's music. And, you know, they're all dressed in black, and you can see that they're really, some of them even paint their faces and change their... There are people nowadays, not many, but there are people who are doing what's called body modification, and they're putting horns in their body. And yeah, there are people doing things like that. They want to already become demons. It's pretty interesting. Yeah. Yeah, they make a forked tongue like a snake and file their teeth.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not common, but it is happening.
Is that Africa, there's a lot of ancestor worship. Is ancestor worship also the worship of ghosts and spirits?
It could be, or it could be a kind of demigod worship, depends on how it's done. Because Vedic also has, you know, the worship of the ancestors, those who go to Pitriloka, and that's considered in the mode of goodness.
Because these people actually believe the ancestors look after them, provide for them.
They may to some extent. That's also Vedic. It is also Vedic.
But is that possible? I mean, if you leave your body, can you really provide for the people who leave the body?
There can be some connection if there is a pious ancestor. In Vedic society, the good, which is one reason people want to have children, and one reason why people want to have good children. Krishna has given an incentive to have good children. If you have good, just like in this life, if you have children and you have good children, they take care of you if there's a problem. Now we have all these government things. But in a normal society, that's one of the main reasons people have children. And after death, if you go to a higher planet, your children can help keep you there. Because you can stay on the higher planet till you use up all the money on your credit card. But if you've got somebody on Earth putting money into your account, like maybe some of you here in India have somebody in the West who keeps putting money into your account. Right? There you go. So that's like you're on the higher planets and you have your descendants and they're putting money into your karmic bank account. So you can stay in heaven longer. So they're very interested. The residents of those planets, like Pitriloka, they really want their children to keep having good children. Because as soon as they don't, then nobody's putting any money into their account anymore, and then they have to leave the heavenly planets. So there is something to that. It depends. It's not that everybody's ancestors are like that, obviously. If your ancestors become a dog, then they're not looking after you.
So it's only like the pot, because I'm thinking, if a person leaves their body naturally, they take birth again. So how can a person, if they leave their body, be in a position where they look after them?
If you're a very pious, elevated person who goes to one of these higher planets, then that's something you can do. Just like there are higher beings who take care of us earthlings all the time. Us earth creatures are very weak. And the whole earth would be overrun by demons if there weren't. The earth is a very valuable planet in the universe. It's always being fought over by the demons and the demigods. They're always trying to control the earth. It's a gateway planet. And we're very weak. If the devas weren't looking after us, we'd be in a lot of trouble. So there are higher beings that are looking after us. All of us. They may not be your ancestors. But if you have good ancestors, yeah, your ancestors may also be on Pitriloka looking out for you. Definitely. I don't think that happens to too many people nowadays, but I'm sure it happens to some.
There's a lot of channeling going on now.
Oh, goodness. Okay, let's stop. Let's not go there. Okay, food in the mode of goodness. I really like what Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur said. And you can see this side of the screen. Thank Loharam for this. He had to work for about 10 minutes to figure out how to do this. It's too bad that there's still so much light in here that it's really, really hard to see this well. Anyway, he said food in the mode of goodness is you earn your money honestly. You cook it purely. It's served in a pure place by pure people. I remember when my son and I visited Mahanidhi Swami in Radhadamodar Temple. This is 18 years ago. And he said, come back tomorrow for prasadam. So we did. And he said, sit down. And he served us. And I said, what are you doing? He said, if I knew you were going to serve me, I wouldn't have come back. He said, in most temples, only the most senior devotees are allowed to serve. Said there's many temples, only the sannyasis are allowed to serve prasadam to anybody. You ever been served by people who don't have the right attitude about serving? So he also says that sattva refers to virtue. It gives you steadiness. The food itself gives you steadiness. Agreeable means it both tastes good and it looks good. And it has some oil. Prabhupada talks about in the purport having oil from milk. By the way, Prabhupada, a number of places, says that the main value of milk is the cream, is the fat content of the milk. And, you know, he talks about how milk nourishes the brain. You know the brain is mostly fat? Do you know that? The brain is like 60 to 70% fat. What kind of oils you eat has a huge effect on your brain. Now, of course, modern milk, that's first of all taken from distressed cows, and then where they homogenize the milk and put the cream in the milk, and who knows what they do. How that changes. I'm not sure if homogenized milk nourishes the brain the same way. And if you drink skim milk, of course, you don't get any benefit at all. You're really fortunate if you can get actual whole real milk from happy cows.
I heard that this Ayurvedic
What is?
Ghee.
Ghee, yes, it is.
Cooking with ghee, and also cooking children with to massage the head with ghee.
Yes, because, I mean, even according to modern medical science, there's medicines can be absorbed through the skin. They sometimes give you transdermal patches, right, to put on. So, yes, keep putting ghee on the head. Coconut oil is also really good if you get good coconut oil. If you get what's called virgin coconut oil.
It's cooling.
Yeah, and it's also good for cooking. Coconut oil is very compatible with the natural brain chemistry. Oh, when we were talking about, you know, can you change your mode? You can change your modes to some extent just by what you eat. So Ayurvedic does talk about the six tastes, sweet, salt, sour, salty, bitter, pungent, and astringent. The idea is if it's too much of any of them in excess, too sweet, too salty. I know one friend who thinks that dessert, one devotee friend who thinks dessert means chili powder and salt. And I'll just eat that.
Sorry,
spicy. Hot.
So
hot.
The hot and
there isn't any. Oh, why does it have two words there? I don't know. That's like pride and arrogance. Pride and arrogance. Okay, ignorance. So, mode of passion food, you suffer in this life. Mode of ignorance food, you suffer in this life and in the next life. I mean, I've also found that doing periodic fasting, if you do a periodic full fast, yes. like if you do Nirjala or Ekadasi, which you should only do if you're in good health, and you don't do a lot of physical exercise. But if you can do that, your body will be lighter and freer and illuminated all the time. It's quite interesting. All right. Then, of course, there's food above the modes. That's another picture from our books. You like that picture? Those are actually chapatis with some plum jam on the top. This is about a little boy. This story is about a little boy who lives at Govardhan, and he asks his mother what she's going to make for Krishna today. And she says, I'm going to make some chapatis. And he said, that's what you make every day. Can we make something different? And she said, yeah, what would you like to make? So he makes some plum jam and puts it on the chapatis.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Things that, like, vinegar, soy sauce, soybean products, what mode is that? Because I know we're not supposed to offer that to the deities.
You know, there's conflicting statements from Prabhupada about some of them. Vinegar, he only says it's in the mode of ignorance. Vinegar is really good for washing clothes, by the way. So we used to always put vinegar in the rinse water in the washing machine. So our shopping list said vinegar on it. And when Sannyasi visited our house, and the next day in Bhagavatam class talked about how vinegar is in the mode of ignorance. I've been through a lot of things like that. And I went to Maharaj, I said to Maharaj, we use it for laundry. You know, next time just ask. But yeah, Prabhupada says that about vinegar. About soy stuff, Prabhupada says different things in different places. Sometimes he says it's fine. So, I don't know. I mean, mostly what I see from Prabhupada on soy is positive. Like 9/10 of what Prabhupada says about soy is positive. And I always thought we weren't allowed to eat mushrooms. And then when Prabhupada's letters books came out, I had to eat humble pie and mushroom soup at the restaurant because they wanted me to prove that I was sorry for having criticized them for so many years.
What did Prabhupada say about mushrooms?
He said it is not generally offered, but they're not prohibited, there's no harm. So I had been criticizing the restaurant in Detroit for years that they served mushrooms. And then when I, because the letter books just got published, and then when I read that, I went and I said, you know, you guys are right and I'm wrong. They say, okay, sit down, eat mushroom soup. So I did. Hare Krishna. There's another place where Prabhupada says that because mushrooms grow in filthy places, we don't generally offer them. So by generally understood, like don't make it part of the Raj Bhog every day.
Yeah.
But he says it's not prohibited, there's no harm. I want you to just notice here, that member I talked about yesterday, that often in passion, the behavior is very similar to goodness, but the motives are different. So here you see that in passion, it's not saying that that person is externally doing something different, but their reasons are different. Their reasons are different. They may be doing a sacrifice according to scripture, but their purpose is different. They want to get money. They want to get a good kid. They want to get fame. They want to have their name put up on a plaque in the temple. In ignorance, they're doing something that's just not, the thing they're doing itself is not right. I want to look at ignorance for a minute. So all sacrificers should be distributing prasadam. One of the nice things about the programs I went to just recently in Dubai, one of the bad things is that they start when they're supposed to end. And one of the, you know, when the programs start, you want to go to say, okay, it's time for me to go to bed now. But one of the nice things is they always distribute prasadam, even if they just give everyone an apple on their way out. You know, if they don't have facility to serve plates, they give people a little box of prasadam. Also, without remunerations to the priests, we have a lot of confusion in ISKCON about whether or not brahmanas should get money. Now, it's a very funny thing because without some wealth, you can't live. You don't necessarily have to have a lot of cash, but you have to have food and clothes and shelter, medicines, you know, stuff like that. Either you have to get the goods or you have to get money. Otherwise, it's pretty hard to live. So, you know, I think part of this problem comes from the fact that in the early days of ISKCON, we all lived in temple ashrams where we gave everything and we got everything. We had no bank accounts. We had no... Some devotees in the early days didn't even have private clothes. They just threw all the clothes into one box and you pulled out something to wear. And I didn't do that. But there are many devotees who did that kind of thing. And then you got everything, you know. The temple just took care of pretty simply, but still pretty much whatever you needed. And we very much got this idea that service means no payment, especially because Prabhupada would often say you shouldn't be paying people a salary. And there were some specific jobs, especially, that he really said you shouldn't be paying a salary. I had an interesting conversation with one professor, Margaret Harris, who's an expert in non-profit religious organizations. And she brought up this point to me. She said, do you have any conception in your tradition that there are certain kind of jobs that should be paid and certain kind of jobs that should not be paid? Or can any job be either done by a paid worker or by a volunteer? Anyway, we definitely have a conception that brahmanas, kshatriyas, and vaishyas should not get salaries. Salaries means that someone is employing you and paying you a set amount on a regular basis. And the problem with the salary is you become owned by that person. Also, when you get a set amount of money on a regular basis, you structure your life so as to depend on getting that amount of money on a regular basis. You end up having bills that have to be paid, and if you don't get that money on a regular basis, you're in a lot of trouble. And because of that, you then become the servant of who's ever giving you a salary. Does that make sense? Brahmin, kshatriyas, and vaishyas don't function very well as servants. First of all, they don't have the mentality to function very well as servants. They make really lousy servants. It's just not their mood. Their mood is to be independent. And also, if a Brahmin is a servant, then he can't be honest. You can't speak honestly if you're worrying about whether or not someone's going to pay you and you've got all these bills that have to be paid and you have to get X number of whatever it is you're getting. Dollars or rands or euros or furans or rubles or rupees or dinars. And you figure if I don't get my 300 dinars, then, you know, I'm going to be in trouble. So you're not going to speak truthfully. Kshatriya can't take proper care of the citizens. Our modern rulers don't take proper care of the citizens. They're controlled by business. And vaishyas cannot properly protect the earth. Again, you can't make... when I was on a plane recently, I watched that movie Food Incorporated. What a movie. Wow. Some very disturbing scenes. But they talked to farmers who were making poor decisions because otherwise they wouldn't get paid. They were using bad crops, they were mistreating their animals because otherwise they wouldn't get paid. And there were some farmers who said, look, I didn't become a farmer to ruin the animals and ruin the earth. And I'm going to just do my own thing, even if I make less money. That's a real vaishya. All right? A real vaishya, a real kshatriya, a real brahmana doesn't want to be somebody's servant. But everybody has to live. So a Vaishya lives by generating wealth. And we'll talk more later about how a Vaishya should generate wealth honestly. A Kshatriya lives by collecting taxes or collecting rent. So Kshatriya is giving some service and collecting rent or taxes. Which is, you may still be getting a regular amount of money, but it's not exactly a set amount of money. It's not exactly like that when you're getting rent money. How does a Brahmin live? A Brahmin lives by charity. A Brahmin lives by charity. Now, if you live by charity, unlike, say, collecting rent or collecting taxes when you might have a pretty good idea of what's coming in, or running a business where you might have a fairly reasonable idea of what's coming in, if you live by charity, you never know what's coming. So in order to live by charity, you have to have a lifestyle that doesn't have a whole lot of fixed expenses. You have to have a very different kind of lifestyle than is very doable in modern society. You know, it's not so easy in most Western countries to just build a straw hut and not have electricity. It's not so easy. But in order for people to actually be brahmanas in society and really be able to be truthful, they have to receive charity. So I was dealing with one temple administrator who had taken over a temple where all the devotees were receiving a salary. The people who lived in the temple, all the cooks, the pujaris, everybody was getting a salary. And he said, I want to stop this. I said, okay, but then you've got to start encouraging your congregation to give the devotees charity. Not just give money to the temple, but also give money directly, or things, clothing, shoes, whatever, food, to the devotees in general. Of course, Prabhupada did say the temple could give devotees like that some pocket money. But this should be something that's encouraged. And I know, you know, we often say that if you take service from someone and you don't repay them, then you're going to be responsible for that. Prabhupada says that. So you have to repay your debt. You know, so if you get some service from somebody who isn't charging a salary, you need to give them some charity. And this is, I see that in ISKCON, devotees who are brahminically minded and want to live a brahminical lifestyle really have a hard time doing it because we have not established this principle of giving charities to the brahmanas. We have established a principle of giving charity to the sannyasis, but we have not established a principle of giving charity to Brahmin grihasthas or Brahmin single women, which there are. So if we do some kind of a jagya and we don't give remuneration to the priest, that's in the mode of ignorance. To just say, okay, I'm going to take from you, and I don't need to give you anything. I can just take whatever. I was talking about that when I was first invited to the MI and Janmasthami was still running things. And he said, well, we make sure that our teachers have a place to stay and food to eat, but none of the students pay the teachers. And I said, then you should tell the students to give the teachers something in charity. That should be something that's established. And this would be something that's established in general in ISKCON. And I think if we did that, this whole question of paying salaries to pujaris and stuff would stop. If people really had that mentality. You know, you'll find the Indians have a mentality of bringing charity to the deities. They're really good about bringing something for the deities. But we're not really training people that there are certain occupations in a temple or in a community of people who are living on charity. So that would be nice.
This fee that we are paying for the course, I was thinking that's for the teachers and paying.
It provides us with a place to stay and food while we're here.
For the ticket?
Not usually. They agreed to pay my ticket to Delhi from here. Like when I teach it, my teaching at Radhadesh paid my ticket here. But here they won't do that. So I just taught two courses at Radhadesh, and they'll pay my ticket to Radhadesh, and they'll pay my ticket. So they paid from London to Calcutta.
So the room you're occupying, you have to pay rent?
Hmm?
There's a fee for the room that you have?
No, that they cover.
Like this fee that we're paying?
I'm sure it pays for the prasadam.
No, it doesn't
pay for the prasadam. It probably also just pays for the care of the people who are running the program.
I'm just surprised that the teachers don't seem to...
Well, the teachers don't get anything, because if the teachers get anything, then all sorts of people complain and say, why are you paying teachers? Teachers shouldn't be paid. So it's a fact. The Prabhupada says teachers should teach for free. You don't teach conditionally on getting paid. If you teach conditionally on getting paid, if you're a Brahmin and you think, let me go there and teach there because then I'll get a good salary, I'll get, you know, that's a good place to get charity. That's a temptation for a preacher, by the way. It's a temptation for a preacher to think, oh, that's a rich person's house, let me give a class there. And they'll give me a donation. It's a temptation. You know, so this is something we haven't worked out in ISKCON yet. We haven't figured this one out. How do you have Brahmins in society who don't get paid and don't get a salary and still are able to function as Brahmanas? I think Krishna manages to take care of everybody in his own way. But it would be nice if we had a society where there was an understanding of this.
Have you brought it to the attention of the GBC at all? Have you brought it to the attention of the GBC?
The what?
The GBC discussed
it. Can I have some more water?
I can't.
You're sick. Can I have some more water? Thank you. I don't think that's the proper way to make changes in an organizational culture.
Oh.
I think there's different ways to make changes in organizational culture. I think the ways to make changes in organizational culture is what I just did.
Okay.
That's much more effective.
So, Varnashram and Dharma is also important
to establish. Let's not even talk about Varnashram. Is the mode of goodness important to establish in ISKCON? Is the mode of goodness important? I mean, we just read that, right? We just read that we'll only be able really to be receptive to Krishna's mercy if we're functioning in goodness. So we're not just studying this to criticize others. I mean, that's fun. We're devotees, and those guys are in ignorance over there. Ha, 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 ha. That's a lot of fun. I think that's called pride and arrogance. Oh, no, never mind. Anyway, we all tend to do that, especially when we're new devotees. But I think that Krishna gave us this instruction also for ourselves, so we can look at our lives and see in what, you know, what modes am I functioning? And I believe the way to change an organizational culture, I mean, it's nice if the leaders change it also, but is through education in the society. That, you know, how do you change an organizational culture so that people feel that it's proper to give, to take care of the Brahmins in the society? Of course, then you have to be a real Brahmana, you know. If you want to live a lifestyle, like Prabhupada says that the Brahmana grahastas sometimes don't live on charity. They may be physicians, or they may be astrologers, or, you know, but if they're living on charity, then they have to live a very particular kind of lifestyle. Basically, you can't live on charity if you have high fixed expenses. It's impossible. You just can't. If you have a fixed amount that you're spending every month, you've got to have a fixed amount that's coming in. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And then immediately you're going to want to go for a salary. You're going to want to go for something that's pretty solid. And you'll be worrying about money. So the only way for a Brahmana to really just live on whatever charity comes is to live without practically any fixed expenses, or with very, very low fixed expenses. And there are devotees who live like that, by the way. You know, they have land that's paid for, and they build their own building, and they have their solar panel, and they have very little fixed expenses. So if Krishna doesn't send, because living on charity means if Krishna doesn't send, that's okay. If Krishna sends, that's okay, and if Krishna doesn't send, that's okay. But part of, if we would like to have people in the movement stop getting salaries. In the early days of the movement, nobody got a salary. you lived in the ashram and you got taken care of. And nowadays, in many, 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 many temples, the people doing brahminical work are getting salaries. And there's a lot of criticism about that. So my point is, you can't stop that unless you provide for them in some other way. You can't just say to people, don't eat. Don't buy your wife a sari. That's not reasonable. You know, so then they have to be provided for in another way, which means we have to have a culture of people giving in charity. That's my point. You can't just say, stop salaries. Then you have to have something else. What do you want instead? You know, you have to have something else there. And if you start having communities that do that, then gradually maybe people will change. Maybe. Okay, austerity. In goodness, there's three items of body, words, and mind, which we'll go through separately. Now, again, passion. The people in passion may be doing the same austerities as the people in goodness, but their motives are different. They want everyone to know they're doing the austerities. I'm doing austerities. Jesus talked about that. And he said, if you're fasting, don't have a sour look on your face. He said, put oil on your hair and wear nice clothes and don't let anyone know you're fasting. He said that the people who want everyone to know about their austerities, they get their rewards. But those who do things privately, he said, they actually get rewarded by God. All right. Now, ignorance, you're doing the wrong things. Your austerities are torturing your body. Or you're doing it for the wrong reason. Trying to manipulate. You're doing austerities to manipulate other people. Or you're doing austerities to hurt other people. Whatever austerities we do in Krishna consciousness should be joyful. They shouldn't be damaging our body or mind. That's also in the mode of ignorance. Okay. Austerity of the body. How am I doing on time? Not good. Okay, austerity of the body, worship of the Lord, worship the Brahmins, worship the Guru, worship the parents, being clean. I wondered if you all would think about this. Maybe all of us could come in on the weekend and clean this place, because I'm really getting frustrated trying to get these guys to clean it. I think we've gotten a little better, but not much. And it's I keep harassing the authorities and harassing the cleaners and... But if you guys are into it, you could put on cleaning clothes and bring some brushes and some cloths and spend a half an hour and have a cleaning party. Simplicity. Simplicity is not having excesses amount. Nonviolence means also not putting anybody else into distress. It doesn't mean just for the body. It means not giving violence to other people's mind. Oh, we could talk about that for a week. How we hurt people to try to get what we want. My goodness. Celibacy, Prabhupada defines in this purport as keep sex to within marriage. In discussing the qualities, the divine qualities, he talked about contraception as being demoniac. Okay, of speech. So we're going to do an exercise on this, so pay attention. Truthful, pleasing, beneficial, not agitating to others, and regularly reciting Vedic literature. Okay, pleasing refers to the content, what you're talking about. Not agitating to others refers to the language, how you are talking about it. So agitating language is like swear words, coarse language where the language itself is disturbing to others, and pleasing refers to the message itself. All right, of all of these, what do you think is the most important? Being truthful. A lot of people say truthful.
Beneficial in a spiritual sense.
What about material? Suppose you had a choice between being truthful and benefiting somebody. what would be higher? Suppose you had to choose between being truthful. Suppose what you said was truthful would hurt somebody. And suppose the only way to benefit somebody would be not to be truthful. Which would be better? So if the truth is going to cause harm, can you think of situations where the truth would cause harm? Yes. Like, I've had to often advise married couples, you can't always be truthful with your spouse. This one devotee wrote me, he said, my wife's always complaining I don't care about her, and the reason is I actually don't care about her. He said, I really don't love her. Should I tell her? I said, no. I said, that would damage your wife, your kid, it would damage you, it would damage everything. Don't tell her. You know, if your wife's gotten old, fat, and ugly, you don't tell her. You don't say, my dear, you've gotten so old, fat, and ugly. I tell men, you always tell your wife she's beautiful. Even if she looks in the mirror and she goes, I'm not really very beautiful. Still, the man should always tell his wife she's beautiful, and the woman should always tell her husband that he's a hero. Always. Never tell him he's a loser.
Oh.
No, never.
You get this one.
That has the same effect on a man as a man going to the woman and saying, you know, I really just don't like you and you're really ugly.
Yeah.
Even if you know you're ugly, you don't want to hear it from your husband. So, beneficial.
So when he married, he saw us, he's beautiful.
Yeah. Well, the day he married you, he saw you as beautiful, but he might not always see you as beautiful. But he should always tell you that, or else just be quiet. So there's... If truth is going to harm somebody, then it shouldn't be spoken. You know, the example that Krishna gives is if the murderers are looking for their victim, you don't say, oh, he went that way. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot about pleasing, and here at the MI, they have given me these quotes to pass out to you, about how we don't have to be pleasing. So I will pass them out to you. Where Prabhupada is saying that we are speaking the real truth without compromise and doesn't matter if it's pleasing or not. That we're not going to change truth in order to be pleasing. However, Prabhupada does say in the purport that things that are not pleasing can only be spoken to ones who read the purport.
Students.
None of us have any business speaking unpalatable truth to people who are not receptive. Because then it hurts people. Part of what makes things, and I like to do all this interactively, and I'm just telling you, and it's really bugging me, but anyway. Lecturing is much more efficient, but you don't learn as much. I usually do this interactive. If someone's not receptive to what you have to say, then telling them an unpleasant truth will hurt them. Who has had the experience of saying an unpleasant truth to an unreceptive person and that person being damaged? Now, I will tell you, why do you think we sometimes tell unpleasant truths to unreceptive people?
Out of arrogance.
Or just ignorance. We don't notice that they're not receptive. But I think it's generally arrogance. I know more than you, and I'm going to tell you whether you want to hear it or not.
Of course we do.
Hmm?
It's also like when you like someone, you want to share whatever you feel.
But if they're not receptive, I've concluded that if someone's not receptive and you force it, it's almost always out of pride that I'm going to show you how much I know than you. And often if the person reacts badly, then we say, oh, just see. Just see now just how terrible they are. So this is, it's very important. And I really try to be conscious of the fact that, like, in this room, you're all my students, but out of this room, you're not. So I can say unpleasant truths in this room, but I cannot say the same unpleasant truth to you when the class is over as an individual, because it's not my place. Unless you come to me and say, okay, Ermil, I'm your student in general. That's another thing. But if all you're right now, you're only my student for the hours you're in this class. most of you, right? You're not my student in general. Another thing about saying unpleasant truths to a group is that if you say unpleasant truths to a group, everybody can think, oh, she's not talking about me. So you can say a lot heavier truths publicly to a group than you can say to an individual. 100, 1,000 times more. You can say very unpleasant, cutting, heavy truths in a public class that you cannot at all say to those very same individuals if you speak to them as individuals. So the best thing is beneficial, and in order to be beneficial, the person has to be receptive. They have to be ready to hear, which means you have to have a certain kind of relationship with them. And I mean, I had one good friend who one time came to me and said, Urmila, what's my biggest fault? And I said, oh, I don't think you have any faults. And she kept pushing, what's my biggest fault? Finally said, I don't think you have any big faults, but if you really want to know here, I think this is a problem. And she was angry at me for a month. I was getting every day I was getting these emails where she was just defending herself. So I'm trying to learn that even when people say that they're receptive, many times they're not. Very, very few people are really open to hearing unpleasant truths to their face as an individual. It's extremely rare. Extremely. I said this once in Bahrain, and I said, you know, generally the spiritual masters only tell the disciples a fraction of what those disciples need to hear. And the temple president got up and he said, our Guru Maharaj tells us everything exactly because we here all do exactly what he says. I said, well, that's nice. Hare Krishna. I said, why don't you ask him? I said, why don't you ask him if he always tells you everything that he would like to tell you, or whether he waits and sees, okay, you're not ready. We're not ready. Sometimes if we wonder why the process doesn't go faster, it's because Krishna's only giving us what we can handle. You know, if he showed us everything, we would break. It means we wouldn't be able to take it.
How about with relatives? Because it's harder to not tell them.
You know, with relatives, we think that they're supposed to be receptive. Yeah. You know the main reason we tell unpalatable truths to relatives? I'm sorry. Is because we want something. And we think that my relative is supposed to give it to me, and we try to force. It's a way of forcing. So we will often hurt the people that are closest to us. We will often hurt as a way of trying to get what we need from them, to try to push them to change and give us what we need, which is a very mode of ignorance thing to do. The only way to conquer that is to have your needs met by your relationship with Krishna. There's no other way. No other way at all. You have to have your needs met by your relationship with Krishna. Only then are you free to have your relatives meet your needs or not meet your needs as they're capable and willing to do. Otherwise, you're going to try to force your relatives to be Krishna for you. And you'll get angry when they're not, and then you'll say unpalatable truths to try to force them.
Couldn't that be a method of teaching something? Maybe when the person is so affected, and maybe he's really hurt.
Maybe. Do you like to be taught like that?
I feel it works with me.
Sometimes. Do you like it?
No.
Do to others what you'd like to be done to you. Sometimes. If someone is your subordinate, if they're your student or your child, if they're your subordinate, and it's absolutely necessary, sometimes you have to do that. Basically, you should try to avoid it. Sometimes it must be done. Sometimes it has to be pushed a little. Sometimes you've got to push somebody into a place where you'd really rather not push them. But please, only if they're your subordinate and only if it's really, really, really urgent. Only if things are just falling apart otherwise and they just can't go on otherwise. Now, that is something you have to do with children. With children, sometimes with servants, with employees, sometimes you just have to, you know, the company's going to go bankrupt, you know, sometimes you just have to call them in and say, look, I'm really sorry, we have this problem. Now, what can be done? Sometimes you can speak words that are agitating to others on the battlefield. Ksatriya is one of the ways they get the enemy to fight is by insulting them. Okay, so this is some guidelines. Is it true? Is what I'm saying true? Can it be supported in the scriptures? Has this person, by their words, social position, or accents, exhibited a sincere willingness to accept the truth that I'm going to speak? So is what I'm going to speak true? And is this person willing to hear the truth? Will both the truth and the way I'm presenting it benefit me and benefit my hearer? Am I presenting it in the most beneficial way possible? That may take time. Is it in pleasing language? So these are the questions to ask yourself. Nice quote from 11th Canto. Sharp arrows which pierce one's chest and reach the heart do not cause as much suffering as the arrows of harsh, insulting words that become lodged within the heart when spoken by uncivilized men. And it's really painful to have harsh words from your family members. That's really, really, really painful. Friends and family members. Okay, austerity of the mind. To be satisfied in all circumstances. The only way to have austerity of the mind. Well, I'm giving you a week's worth of instruction in two sentences. These are like sutras here. The only way to have this austerity of the mind is to trust that Krishna is going to meet all of your needs and to trust that the way he's meeting your needs is what's most beneficial for you. Like a child. Just like parents, good parents, even most parents, even if they're not such good parents, they meet their children's needs. Children's parents give their children food and clothes and education, and shelter, and friends, and toys. Right? I mean, unless they're terrible parents. Isn't it? But they don't always give those things in the way that the children appreciate. Sometimes the children don't like the way their parents are meeting their needs. So if you have complete trust, Krishna will meet all of my needs, all of them, all the time. And sometimes the way he meets my needs will not make sense to me. Sometimes it may even seem the opposite of getting my needs met. Then you can have this mentality. Because then you can be satisfied in any circumstance. You'll never try to force somebody to do something for you or to meet your needs. And you'll give up the desire to dominate material nature, which is the weakness of heart. Because you won't think you're going to get your needs met from material nature, you think you're going to get your needs met from Krishna. Krishna can use another person or use whatever to meet your needs, but you'll see that it's coming from Krishna. Without that, this austerity in the mind is not possible. And each one is more difficult. So when one is fixed in all these austerities of body, speech, and mind, then one has attained to the platform of Brahma-Bhuta or Nishta. One is then established in goodness. When you're established in goodness, when you're at the platform of Nishta, the hard struggle in Krishna consciousness is over. You're feeling controlled by the modes of passion and ignorance is over. You become joyful and you become fearless. And then you can start understanding Krishna as he is and do devotional service on a deep level. Okay, I am really not doing well here with time. I am a half an hour behind. All right, but you guys need a break. Can we just take 5 minutes? Is that all right? Get some sun, get some water, stretch. Okay, 5 minutes.
Seminar about